There have been times in my life when I thought I was going to bleed to death. Everything changed for me after I got COVID for the first time in August 2022. My health took a nosedive. My monthly cycle got longer and heavier. I ended up in the ER, and after an ultrasound, I was told that I had uterine fibroids. After growing for years, my fibroids were now too big, and surgery was my only option. But I would have to wait 2 years because of the gynecology waitlist in Ontario. The bleeding continued and I was put on medication that pushed me into early menopause. I felt awful. And after more than 50 days of constant bleeding, I ended up in the ER again. And once again, I was told there was nothing that could be done for me. I had to wait for surgery. I had nightmares of bleeding out in the middle of the night and my children finding me on the bathroom floor in the morning. This was the start of my fibroid journey, but it's not a unique one. So, what is a fibroid? A fibroid is a benign tumor of the uterus. There can be multiple or just one. They can grow with time and can cause severe pain and bleeding that can lead to anemia, among other complications. For some women, they don't have any symptoms. And by age 50, 70% of women can have them, up to 80% for Black women. Treatment for fibroids can involve painkillers, hormone therapy, and surgery, including hysterectomy. I didn't even know that there were different types of fibroids, depending on where they're located. And lucky me, I had two of the worst types. One of the major issues with fibroids is that we know so little about them. We don't know what causes them. Research spending comes nowhere close to what we spend on treating them. But women are starting to speak up about their experience with fibroids, like Oscar-winning actress Lupita Nyong'o, tennis legend Venus Williams, and many more, including our guest today, Amber Mack. She's an author, entrepreneur, and podcast host who told her fibroid story over social media. "I was drowning at times, I really was. Amber's voice was a lifesaver. When I saw what she had been posting online, I felt less alone." She joins me now. Amber Mack, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. We still live in a world where, I mean, before I had my surgery and I still have my period, I would have to hide my pad and just kind of like Inspector Gadget my way to the bathroom.
Yep.
And I'm like, I'm a grown woman. I've got kids. Like, why am I still embarrassed about my period? It's still, we still live in those times where there's a lot of stigma around periods and bleeding. Why did you speak up publicly about what you were going through?
I think one of the things that I went through in the early days of having fibroids and then anemia and many, many treatments and eventually surgery was that it really impacted my work. And what I mean by that is I had to turn down a lot of events that maybe people I even work with don't even realize that I turned down because I was kind of limited in terms of what I could do. So I found one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about it is because I thought there are so many women who are likely suffering in silence, who don't have the ability just to kind of take time off or step away from their work, who are still going to work and every day showing up. And the more I was researching this topic, the more I realized that this is a bigger issue, I think, than we're talking about. So I really wanted to kind of, you know, lift the secrecy around this topic of fibroids and be more open about it. And I also started to see more women do that. And I think that also really helped to empower me to know that, hey, it was okay. This is a safe place to go to have these discussions. And hopefully that leads to fewer women having to suffer in silence, because that's the reality.
Because I think there's this idea that at work, you're supposed to lean in until you're like on the table, lying on the table. There's also this pressure to just always kind of push through. But when it comes to your body, like fighting against you in the workplace, if it's not a personal failing, it, and having gone through, you know, the surgery backlog and all the things. It's a failing of the system. How would you sum up your experience with the system, with your condition?
I think it was a total failing of the system. I think there were many examples along the way when I was seeking treatment where I was really dismissed. You know, I had situations where I showed up in an emergency room and I was told by a doctor that, oh, you know, you're just having your period. And then finally, you know, another doctor came to see me and they recognized that, oh my God, your hemoglobin is really low. And that can lead to a whole other host of issues. And then I ended up getting admitted. But really my first encounter oftentimes within that healthcare system was one of doubt, one that put me in a situation where I was often dismissed. And I would think, even, I think it's fair to say, kind of ridiculed, right? I had a surgeon who I met with eventually throughout this journey who and didn't end up being my actual surgeon. But when I went to meet with her, she actually, I could hear her kind of giggling outside the room about how big my fibroids were. And again, this is another example of the system just not really taking these situations seriously enough. Eventually, I found a surgeon who was phenomenal, and I feel like she saved my life. But I would certainly say that it was a year and a half of really kind of traumatic experiences along the way.
It's shocking to hear you say that, someone who's supposed to help you, making fun of your condition. But I think also when you share that story, people must be like, oh, that can't be it. Because I've heard a lot from people who say, oh, that couldn't have been what you went through.
Yeah, I mean, I specifically remember meeting this doctor, and she had told me after I met with her that it would be a 2-year wait for me to get into surgery. I think a lot of women hear that. That's kind of the timeline, 2 years. At this point, I had spent many, many months getting monthly infusions. I had been in and out of the emergency room. I was barely able to leave my house for more than a couple of hours because I would bleed through my pants. And this was kind of my reality. And so she was one of the people along the way who really dismissed my situation. She was one of them who I specifically remember I left her office in tears because I heard her speaking outside to a nurse, kind of laughing about the fact that, oh, this woman's fibroid is like a really large fibroid that would be a difficult thing to remove. And it really, I think, puts pressure on a woman at one of the worst times in their lives where they just really need help. And I think that, you know, there are those great doctors, and I found my way to one. But let me be very clear. That was a journey that took months and months and months and months to finally find a doctor, Dr. McGrattan. I'm going to give her a big shout out at Mount Sinai. The first time I met with her, she said to me, your quality of life is suffering. I can see that, and I hear that in everything you've told me. We're going to do our best to get you into surgery as quickly as possible, and you matter. And that was just, you know, it was waterworks, right? For me, right? Yeah. Like, how is this the first person after meeting with, I want to say, 3 or 4 doctors who actually took me seriously enough to say, hey, you know, I'm going to do my best to get you the care that you need. And otherwise, what had I experienced, what many women experience, you know, the situation where you're sitting in an emergency room, often by yourself. You know, I had a young family at home, and, you know, I'm bleeding so much that there's no one to help me, right? And it's
and
not taken
seriously.
You were
going seriously. Through this too, through COVID. So
yes, and through COVID. I mean, it's a really isolating thing. And I think, you know, I think people kind of normalize women bleeding, but don't actually explain that there's a certain point where that's just not normal and where you do need help and you do need support. And we shouldn't have to wait 2 years to get that support.
You brought up a lot of things that I want to follow up on, but I also want people to understand that women doctors can also be the ones perpetuating that harm to other women, because that's also been my experience as well. When did you first find out that you had fibroids?
The first time I found out that I had fibroids, I eventually ended up seeing a gynecologist. And I want to say maybe that was, like I said, I saw many doctors on this path, so maybe the second person in. And eventually she sent me for an ultrasound. And then after that, I went for an MRI. And so it was confirmed over the course of, you know, many, many months. This was not something that happened overnight. I didn't even know about fibroids. I had not even really heard the term fibroid, which is insane because we know that, you know, 4 out of 5 women do get fibroids in their lifetime. And so it was a situation where I was kind of in shock that this had happened. And I had a real learning journey to figure out what exactly was happening to me. So it took a long time. I was kind of dismissed for many, many months of this just being heavy periods, and I would just have to suffer through it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned 4 out of 5 women. We know that 70% of women by the age of 50 will have fibroids. It's higher for Black women, 80%. But we don't really know very much about them. Why do you think that is?
I think one of the reasons, and certainly I think as you do more and more research about this topic, you start to realize that there just hasn't been a lot of money put into researching women's health issues. And so what ends up happening is that women kind of do end up suffering in silence, and there's not a lot of knowledge that's being built around why women get fibroids, what to do about fibroids, and even publicly having conversations about fibroids being a risk for a lot of women, right? From the time we're young girls and we start menstruating, we're kind of taught to take our tampon or pad and hide in our pocket and scurry away to the bathroom and do all of that in silence behind closed doors. And so this has been something that has been just perpetuated. We live in a system where women's health is not taken seriously, not just not taken seriously. There's no money behind the research. And so this impacts us at a systemic level. And that's why, you know, both you and I have suffered, along with thousands of other women in Canada.
You're a forward-facing person. You're an entrepreneur. You're a mother. You're married. When you go out and, like, when I had fibroids, it wasn't just the bleeding that I had to plan for. If I was in the field, I would have to look to see where the washrooms were. And in some situations, there was no washrooms anywhere. And it became a little stressful trying to plan my day. Like, where's the nearest bathroom? Should I take extra pants? My hair started to fall out. And being on TV, you know, your appearance is part of the gig. How did you manage that, being a forward-facing person where, you know, in a lot of situations for the work that you do, you're standing on stage, many, many people are looking at you, listening to what you're saying, but inside, all of this stuff is happening?
I think it was a really difficult couple of years in terms of being able to manage the public side of this health issue that I was facing, because you're right. I was often on stage keynoting. You know, I'm speaking to large audiences of people. I can't, in the middle of a 1-hour keynote, get off stage and say, oh, you know, I got to go to the bathroom. Excuse me. That's just not appropriate. And so what ended up happening along the way is I started to turn things down. I started to sort of look inward and think, oh my gosh, you know, maybe this career just isn't for me. Maybe I just need to back off. Maybe this part is part of just getting older as a woman. I remember thinking eventually I actually cut out all of my travel for speaking events, and I stopped traveling entirely. And one of the reasons I did that is that I was really quite confident that I would end up in an emergency room in a city where I didn't have any support or family. And these were very real things that I did face. You know, I remember being on stage and many, many times, including interviewing the prime minister, where I was sincerely worried about bleeding through my pants. I mean, these are not normal things that people should have to deal with. Women should not have to face this in our
society.
And quietly. And so as I started backing away from my work and sort of retreating into my house and not really socializing, I mean, you know, we talked about what happens professionally, but also socially, right? Because you don't want to go to someone's house. I mean, what if they have a white couch? I mean, all of these things are running through your head. And so I was very isolated for a couple of years and just coming out of the COVID years as well. So to me, I feel like one of the ways that I managed is I just kind of blocked everyone and everything out. And I just made my life as small as I could possibly make my life. And then as I got closer to the point where things got even more serious, I had one canceled surgery because I was bleeding too much. They weren't able to actually do surgery. It got to the point where many nights I thought, I might die. Like, I legitimately might die. My family came home and found me in a pool of blood, called the ambulance. I mean, I spent many times going in and out of the ER. And so I was also sort of preparing for, what if I'm not around? Like, who's going to take care of my family? And these were very real things that I think I was facing, again, not alone, because so many other women were facing this as well.
Sorry.
No, I get it. I was trying not to cry. I'm like, yeah, it sounds like we're exaggerating when we say these things, but I know when I said that, I know you've experienced that too.
Yes, I think that's the thing that kind of... I was in the bathroom thinking that this is how I'm going to die. And I think that's part of the reason why I decided to talk about it publicly, because I remember being in the ER once at St. Mike's, and the head gynecologist said, I've never seen anything like this before, because it just would not stop bleeding. And then they were like, oh, but I can't do anything for you. Here's tranexamic. What is
transamic
it? Transamic acid.
Oh, yes. I had a prescription for that.
Yeah, right. They gave me an IV and they let me go. My blood pressure was through the, you know, the roof. And as long as they got the bleeding under control, they sent me home. And then only for a few hours later for it to happen all over again.
Well, I think to your point, I think there are also people who work in healthcare who aren't aware of some of these issues that mm-hmm. happen with women and fibroids and the consequences of that and the excessive bleeding. I had an experience at Mount Sinai where I was in the emergency room and I was there for a couple of hours. I was bleeding through everything. I mean, you know, all the pads, all the things, my pants. Then I put my jacket around me, bleeding through the jacket. And then I was like, I got to go to the bathroom and like change and do something. I went to the bathroom and blood just everywhere. I mean, all over the floor. I mean, it was so much blood. And then I yelled at a nurse, like, can you come in and help me? Because like, I can't control this. And a male nurse came in and he looked at me and he was like, we need to rush you right in. Like, you're not waiting anymore. And he, I could tell, could not believe the amount of blood.
Because if any other condition, if anybody else presented themselves to the ER bleeding like that, immediately something would be done.
Yes.
But I think there's this kind of again, that it's just a period.
Of course.
Because I heard it's just a period. It's just fibroids.
Yeah. And also I think, you know, again, like with fibroids, people may think, oh, you're not going to die from fibroids. But guess what? There are complications that you experience. And that means that you become anemic. You know what life is like being anemic?
Can you describe it?
It sucks. Yeah. I mean, you know, as a public speaker, I thought in my 40s, I was developing an anxiety disorder because I had lost my breath when I was speaking. And I started to panic when I was on stage, right? Because I couldn't catch my breath because I was so winded. Mm-hmm. You kind of lose your breath. You struggle to go upstairs. You're really lightheaded, very faint a lot, not in a great decision-making mindset. These are not great things for a keynote speaker mm-hmm. or someone in the media, in the public eye. So the anemia, to me, the side effects of fibroids are devastating as well.
Your heart's working harder. It's getting less oxygen. Like all the, when you start reading about what it actually is, it's not just in your head. Your body is fighting for its
yes.
life.
Yes, it's fighting for its life. And I think what ends up happening is that, you know, unless you have proper care, you're going to be in and out of emergency over and over again. You're going to be dismissed over and over again. And even treatment for anemia is actually a pretty intense treatment because, you know, you're having IVs every month. I think I had 16 months of infusions just to kind of keep me alive and functioning. So that's a lot, right?
And it was expensive. How much
yes.
money did you spend on those iron infusions?
Thousands of dollars. I mean, we're talking, I think, $6,000 or more out of pocket to get a certain type of iron that the province didn't cover. So that's another, I think, added expense and another example of how the system is really broken for women. Mm-hmm. Because the province covers some medication, but not all medication. They don't cover the best iron that you can get, and it takes the least amount of time, and it's the most effective. So there's another example of how women, I think, are really kind of disrespected when it comes to women's healthcare right here in Ontario and across the country too.
And I think, I guess this is an opportunity for us to both speak about privilege because we both have the privilege. We have the privilege of being in forward-facing positions. And I think we have more access. Like when I talked about it on social media, I would have people DM me and say, I've been talking about this for so long, but no one is listening to me. Whereas you and I sharing online, people might respond in a different way. If you don't have those safety nets or even just the ability to speak up for yourself, it creates an additional barrier to actually get the care that you need.
This is one thing that I thought about a lot when I was suffering through this. I thought I have the resources to be able to get access to some of the best people in terms of advice and work with different healthcare providers. I have access to knowledge online, you know, access to computers and technology, and I'm literate enough to know how to go through all of this. I have a supportive husband and family, and I have all of these layers of help. And yet, even with all of that, it still was one of the most devastating things that I have ever gone through. It, you know, to the point where after I went through this and I met with my doctor and I said to her, you know, waking up in the middle of night after surgery and in every single dream that I had, I die, I bleed to death. And she was like, you have post-traumatic stress disorder, like from the situation that you went through. And if someone like me or you who has access to all of these resources and the privilege of being able to get information and network and work with people in the biggest city in Canada, what is anyone going to do who lives in a small town and doesn't have any of those things? Mm-hmm. They're not going to suffer for 2 or 3 years. They're going to suffer potentially for decades. And that is just totally unnecessary.
And I also should mention, I had a family doctor. So when it came down to finding a gynecologist, because I was told 2 years, and I was in and out of the ER maybe every month getting the infusions. And so my family doctor essentially called gynecologist, like cold called, and said, can you take her? Can you take her? I had a family doctor. So I can only imagine if you don't have a family doctor and you can't, because the family doctors also send the referrals for the gynecologist. That's an additional barrier to the system that a lot of people in this province are also facing.
It really is. And I think, like you, having spoken about this in public, I wrote an op-ed in the Globe and Mail about my experience after I went through this and had surgery. And I had hundreds of women write me messages that were almost too hard to read. Messages of women, again, who don't live in big cities, who don't have access to a family doctor, who don't have money for infusions that they absolutely need. And it was heartbreaking to see that there were, I'd say, hundreds of these women who were reaching out to me directly who were suffering again in silence. And we know those numbers are even bigger, right? And to me, I think this is something that is so entirely avoidable. That's the hard part of this, right? None of us had to go through years and years of this. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are, right? And we're not alone. I mean, there's a group of us, I think, who've mm-hmm. kept in touch over these years in terms of what we've gone through. But our experiences are actually quite similar.
They are all very similar. You mentioned PTSD. How did you process what you've been through?
I think one of the things that it does is it kind of hardens you, right? I think you go through anything like that and you become sort of a different person. And I think it changes you. I certainly went through that experience where it absolutely did change who I was as a person. I think one of the things that it did to me as well is that it made me just increasingly frustrated about the fact that women of all ages are going through this. Women in so many different communities are going through this. And I even talk to women, you know, who might be in their 20s or 30s who are telling me that they're, you know, they have a really heavy period or they're having, you know, symptoms of anxiety, you know, their heart's racing really fast. And then they go to their doctors to try to get help. And again, they're totally dismissed. I mean, this is systemic to the point that I don't know how we change this without a massive change in the system itself, because it feels like it's so pervasive. Mm. And it's something that, again, it isn't about women just hitting a certain age. I mean, this is built in from the time women are quite young that, hey, this is just what happens.
It's actually really scary for half the population, for our health to just be dismissed and just kind of like just get on with it.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And I think it's one of those things where, yes, I think, you know, publicly there are these conversations about equality, like, you know, women and men in the workplace, like we're getting to the point where, hey, you know, women and men are getting paid close to the same amount, not quite there yet, but we're inching our way towards that. Well, how can we even think about achieving that when we know that there are so many women who are suffering when it comes to healthcare issues that are not being addressed properly or effectively? That is also part of equality, right? And so to me, it is kind of doing a bit of a disservice to say that, oh, hey, like we have a society where women and men are treated equally. No, we're not. When it comes to healthcare, it's not equal at all. And this is setting women back. And this is an issue that needs to be addressed with a significant amount of attention as well as money.
The cost of fibroids is quite staggering. In the United States, $42.2 billion is spent annually on them, while funding for research comes nowhere near that cost. What do you think of that disparity?
Well, I think the disparity is pretty shocking. And I think what we see more and more is that there's just not adequate funding when it comes to, again, I'd go back to the research point. There's not a lot of research done.
And because funding, we don't know what causes fibroids.
We don't, right? Which is, to me, is kind of the starting point, right? We should, at this point, kind of recognize what causes fibroids. also, I think on an educational level, every healthcare professional should be able to spot and identify issues of potential fibroids, which would be things that would come up in an average blood test. I mean, we both know that at this point. You know, you see a blood test where you start to see numbers like hemoglobin falling. These are serious red flags. And so we need to take these issues seriously. And I think, you know, it's one of those situations where, to me, it feels like, as much as you and I have been talking about this, other people have been talking about this on social media and in the media, have we really made any changes over the past couple of years? Has anything changed that makes you hopeful about the future?
No.
Nothing.
No, I think the only thing that's made me hopeful is that I think women are fed up. And maybe finding community online. The fact that we're talking about it, I think, is it's different from the previous generations. The thing that makes me want to scream is that if 4 out of 5 women have fibroids, and I understand that some women can have fibroids and nothing happens, because again, it depends on where your fibroids are located, what types of fibroids you have. Again, no one told me any of those things. And even when I first had fibroids, it was shortly after I had my second child. And I think I had fibroids when I was pregnant with her, because the surgeon, I had a C-section, says to me, and I was in my mid-30s at the time, said to me, do you want me to give you a hysterectomy?
Okay.
And I was like, what? Like, I just met you.
A little forward.
A little forward. Take me out for dinner first.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was quite shocking that, but then when I think back, I'm like, oh. And then I just never felt well. And so I went through my charts and there was a mention of fibroids in 2016. And no one ever said, this could be the reason why you're feeling terrible, right? So if you don't know what causes it and doctors still dismiss it, then the treatment part of it, why did you make the decision ultimately to have surgery?
I actually didn't want to have a hysterectomy. I tried everything. That was the last thing that I wanted. I did
it. Which makes my heart break.
Yeah, I that was not my goal. I was not okay with that. I was not thinking this was a quick solution. So I initially actually wanted to do something that was non-invasive. And there are some non-invasive processes like UFE, which is like an ablation. There are other sort of non-invasive minor surgeries that you can do as well.
But that also depends on where the fibroid's located and what type of fibroid.
Exactly. So my whole experience was like, okay, I wasn't the right person for the ablation or the UFE because of I had a submucosal fibroid.
Me too. Yes. Terrible fibroid.
Yes, terrible fibroid. Yeah. So very problematic. And then endometriosis, you had the same thing.
Yeah.
So it ended up being they were going to do sort of a non-invasive surgery where they would go in and they would remove the fibroids. And that was kind of my goal. I had surgery set for December of 2022. So I was, you know, had taken almost 2 years to get to that point, super excited. But guess what? If you don't stop bleeding, then you aren't able to get that surgery. So
Because blood's important.
Blood's important. Mm-hmm. So I was put on a drug to totally stop my period. And that actually worked for about 6 weeks. I wasn't bleeding at all. It has a bunch of side effects. I think you know about this as well. And then all of a sudden, a couple of weeks before my surgery, the drug just wasn't working. And I just started bleeding nonstop, you know, day after day after day. And devastating, having waited so long for this surgery that they canceled my surgery. And then I had a consultation with my surgeon, again, Dr. McGrattan. And she said to me, you know what, if you were my sister, I would tell you that your best choice at this point is hysterectomy. And when she said that to me, I thought, I believe her 100%. You know, she's gotten me this far. I know that she has understood my reasoning behind doing something that was less invasive, but this is just too serious of a situation and I'm going to have hysterectomy. So I only mention that because before you get to the, oh, hysterectomy solves all your problems, a lot of us have gone through a journey where nothing else was right for us as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about that grief because I didn't want that either, but I felt like I couldn't talk about it because how dare I? Knowing also that there were so many other people who were in line, just waiting to see a gynecologist,
yes,
just waiting to have any kind of care with the things that they were going through. And then I have the surgery and then I'm going to like feel sorry for myself and cry. How did you navigate the grief around getting a hysterectomy?
Well, I think, first of all, I think one of the things that I really faced in terms of that grief was recognizing that this is a major surgery. We talk about hysterectomy, I think even historically, as just like, oh, you know, this is something that a lot of women go through. It's a hysterectomy. This is a significant surgery. It's a major surgery. And also there are different types of hysterectomy, which again, I had to get educated about. So to me, I think, you know, the grief was around the fact that, okay, this was a significant surgery that was going to really impact my body, right? Like I tried to be as prepared as possible, but we're not just talking about removing the uterus. For many of us, they remove the fallopian tubes,
the cervix.
And if you're lucky and you have a good doctor who understands that maybe it might not be right to remove the ovaries, you get to keep your ovaries, which is very exciting. But then I also didn't realize that for some women with fibroids, not only are you cut open, but you also essentially birth your fibroids where they take them out vaginally. So, you know, as someone who's had a baby, I'm like, wait a second. So you're cutting me open and then basically vaginally you're going to remove the fibroids that way.
Make it make sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is kind of a traumatic type of thing, right? And so I had to kind of really educate myself around what exactly was happening. And I think, again, you know, being media savvy like you, I was able to have enough information on hand, and it was still really traumatic. But what traumatizes me even more than my own personal situation is talking to women who've had a hysterectomy who don't even know if they still have their ovaries because their doctor didn't explain it to them. They didn't explain that you can go directly into menopause, because if they remove your ovaries, sometimes you do have that sudden onset of menopause, and they don't even know because no one bothered to tell them.
Mm-hmm. Well, no one told me that. So I found out the hard way. Also, when you do have a hysterectomy, even if you keep your ovaries, which I still have, your body is just kind of like, what happened? So your whole system. And the other part about it is the insurance of saying women get better 6 to 8 weeks. And that's not necessarily true. So there's a lot of like recovery things that we don't talk enough about. And again, we're finding the conversations once again online.
Yeah, this is a multi-year process, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. You know, it is not a similar situation to a lot of surgeries mm-hmm. where, you know, leading up to the surgery, there's a few months, you get surgery, and then a few months of recovery. This is a multi-year process that for many of us, I had surgery 2 years ago. I still have pain all in my right side. No idea why. It has happened since I've had that surgery. I've had lots of ultrasounds. I have no idea why I have that pain.
Are we the same person? Because yeah. I have pain on my right
yeah.
side.
Yeah, I have no idea. They're like, there's nothing wrong with you. And I'm like, well, this is weird because I still have pain on my right side. The more I walk, if I do a lot of walking or exercise, still get pain all down my right side. And so to me, it just feels like this is something that a lot of women are suffering with, not just before they might be lucky enough to get surgery, but also after surgery for years and years. And they don't even have anyone to be that partner in recovery either, right? And that's a serious situation too.
Because I think people get tired of hearing that you're in pain. That's the impression that I get, because when you're in chronic pain, or if you tell your friends, I can't make it to the thing because I just don't feel well. It's like people have moved on and they want you to move on.
Well, I also think they tend to sort of dismiss it and contextualize it as, well, you know what? You're not almost bleeding to death. So big deal, you have pain. You know, you've gone from being really anemic and being dependent on infusions and suffering, you know, with being able to breathe. And now you have a little pain in your side. Who cares, right? But it's dismissive, right, in many of the scenarios.
I know this is off topic, but I just saw something on the CBC that said that women who get hysterectomies too young and go into menopause too young have a higher likelihood of getting dementia, which is terrifying, because that has been the solution for so long when we have reproductive problems. Is not even problems, is so like... and illnesses, diseases.
Yeah.
And that's been the solution, get a hysterectomy, but it's impacting our whole body in different ways that, you know, because we're under-researched, underfunded, who knows, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's connected to the whole body because it is also hormonal, right? So you do hear these studies that have been done that connect, and I've seen that same story, connect women who've had a hysterectomy to dementia later in life. I mean, those type of things are terrifying. So that's what I mean. This is sort of a multi-year thing that's happening during a time for most women that should be kind of, you know, the prime of their lives, right? And so to me, it feels like, hey, you know, you have all these politicians and all these business leaders talking about, we're in a productivity crisis. Like, we need more AI. We need more of this. Guess what we need? We need better healthcare. We need people to be able to show up at work you know, healthy. And if you have 50% of the population where, again, 50% of them potentially have women's health issues in the prime of their working life, and you don't address that, you're never going to get productivity. You can slap AI on all you want. You're never going to see the outcome that you want. So I don't know why people don't take this more seriously, but if we don't have a big shift, I think, in this country, you're going to see more and more women that are left behind. That's just a reality of our workforce.
What do you think is missing? What do you think could be a solution for what's happening right now?
Well, frankly, I think we don't have a lot of women in senior leadership positions in government who probably have gone through these experiences. I mean, if you look at our provincial leaders, and no disrespect to any of them, but the reality is there's not a lot of women who would recognize this to be a serious issue when we think about healthcare. I think that's part of it. I think also that the funding in terms of research around women's health issues has it's been chronically underfunded over the years. I mean, this is a situation here in Canada as well as the U.S. and other parts of the world. So we need more money, recognizing that this is a serious issue. And then again, I go back to more education, even within the healthcare system. So in emergency rooms, if a woman comes in and she's bleeding so much, she's bleeding through her pants, you know, she may have an issue that is bigger than just a heavy period or that time of the month.
Mm-hmm. There's still a culture of silence around women's health. If you're the people who are in positions of power, if they're not addressing it because maybe it's not impacting them, I'm surely they must have a girlfriend, a sister, a neighbor who's going through those issues. But if there's also still a culture of silence around what's happening to women's bodies, how do we get people talking about it more?
Well, I think it's a start to have more women who are out in the open having these conversations. So there's not as much stigma around talking about fibroids and bleeding excessively. So I think, to your point, that's kind of only changed over the past few years, at least from what I've seen in the media. Women are starting to talk about some of the healthcare issues that they're facing. So I feel like that's a good first step so that women aren't really suffering in silence. That is a big part of it. It shouldn't have to happen behind closed doors. And women shouldn't have to be in a position where they are making their lives so small that they don't leave their houses. Because that's my biggest fear right now, that that is legitimately happening in many communities. And again, that has so many consequences that I think people are just totally unaware about.
Mm-hmm. And when you do kind of draw yourself inward, we found each other online. And in the past few years, a lot of celebrities have come forward to talk about specifically fibroids. ABC News anchor Lindsay Davis, Venus Williams, Lupita Nyong'o. Why do you think this is happening right now?
I think we've gotten to the point where I think women have said enough is enough. And I think we've gotten to the point where as the more we talk to each other, the more we have these conversations, you know, the direct messages across social media, the more we realize that the numbers are so big that you just cannot ignore this problem anymore. Because the more women I see come out and talk about this, especially on social media, I think the more women that feel comfortable coming out and talking about this, and then they'll talk to their doctors, and then they'll raise more awareness. So I think that part of it, I think, is a really good thing. But I think the disappointing thing is that when you hear celebrities who have, you know, 100 times the resources that we do, that they have suffered the same journey and the same path.
Yeah.
That's a little discouraging. And listen, when I go through my Instagram feed and I start to see some of these posts, I mean, it's pretty traumatic. Like, you're seeing actual fibroids being removed from women, and they're the size of grapefruits, right?
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah. Like, or even bigger, or there's dozens of them, whatever that might be. I think the more stories that we have like this, I think that it's going to start to raise more awareness about it. But I think that's only kind of step one. There's many other steps as well.
What do you hope for women's healthcare in Canada?
I hope we start to take women's health care much more seriously than we've done so to date. Women are not just baby-making machines who are important up to the point that they give birth. After that, there's still a lot of really complex health issues that women face, especially in the prime of their life. And I think what we need to recognize is that if we care about women in our society and we care about the economic value that they bring to our society, we have to start taking women's health care seriously and put more money and attention on this issue. And it can't happen in a few years. It has to happen today, because our stories, again, are not unique just to us. These are stories of hundreds of thousands of women.
How are you feeling today?
I feel pretty good today. I mean, I'm very grateful that I've had the surgery, that is behind me, that nightmare, you know, is more or less over for me. So I do feel really good. You know, I definitely had that feeling that the moment after I woke up from surgery where I was just so happy that I would never, ever have to wake up in a pool of my own blood again, because I didn't know how much more of that I could personally take. Mm. And so, you know, in comparison to that time, I'm feeling pretty good, but also I think deeply hurt and affected by the fact that for many women, it's still the beginning of that journey. And that's really sad.
And thank you again for having the heart and the fire in the belly to talk about this publicly, because I was drowning. I really was. When I saw your story, I just felt less alone, because this path, this journey is very lonely. And you kind of, it's like you breathed in courage into me for me to be louder and to shake the table more. So thank you for being a pioneer.
Oh, well, thank
you. I'm really grateful.
Talking about this as well. And I probably should give a shout out to Sasha Exeter, because for me, she was the first person I actually saw in my own little community here in Toronto talk publicly about her issues that were similar. And so I think for all of us, it's like passing this terrible baton to each other that we never want to pass, but we are there to support each other. So I feel the same way about you and so many other women too.
Yes, a lot of love to Sasha Exeter. She was great too. She sent me like bone marrow like broth after my surgery. I was like, I love you, so great. And Vivian K.
Yes, and Vivian, yes, yeah. Big shout out to her as well.
She also spoke about it publicly. Thank you, Amber.
Thank you so much.
It's been a privilege to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
This was Mistreated for September 30th, 2025, our first episode. We hope you liked it. You can follow our show on Apple Podcasts so that you can get notified each time a new episode is available. And you can see the video podcast version on the TVO Today YouTube channel. We would love to hear your feedback. You can write us an email at mistreatedpodcast@tvo.org. Thank you to everyone who has reached out since our trailer went live. It means a lot hearing from you all. This week's episode was produced by Matthew O'Mara and myself. Additional camera work by Max Tussey. Digital shorts by Ariana Longley. Production support from Jonathan Halliwell and TVO's digital media services team. Lori Few is the executive producer of digital. John Ferry is vice president programming and content. And special thanks to our studio crew here at TVO. Thanks so much for listening.
If you're enjoying this series, please consider supporting TVO with a donation to make more insightful and thought-provoking podcasts possible. TVO is a registered charity, and you will receive a tax receipt for your gift. Visit tvo.org/givetvo to make your donation today.